Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, climate change, receding glaciers, and melting ice sheets are causing the oceans to rise dramatically. What does that mean for the world's coastal cities? Then, science contradicts long-held societal myths about addiction and the most effective means of addressing it. Average global sea levels will rise by 20 to 30 feet, say researchers. What could the rise mean for coastal cities all over the Earth? Two experts join us. Andrea Dutton is a professor in the Department of Geological Sciences at the University of Florida. She is the author of Ice Volumes and Sea Level During the Last Interglacial that was published in the journal Science. Brian Fagan is an emeritus professor of anthropology at the University of California, Santa Barbara. He's the author of more than 40 books, including his latest, The Attacking Ocean, The Past, Present, and Future of Rising Sea Levels. Welcome, Andrea Dutton, Brian Fagan. Great to have you both with us. Brian Fagan, I want to begin with you, your research for the book, The Attacking Ocean. Let's start with where you start, the Ice Age. Sea levels, you said, were something like 120 meters lower than they are today. But the change was gradual. How did this start and come up to where we are today?
Well, basically, over the last 10,000 years, as I understand it, there was a fairly rapid rise after the Ice Age when warming began. It was irregular, but the rising continued. And then about 6,000 BC, maybe around there, maybe a little later, things stabilized. And there was a long period when there were very minor changes. And then after 1860, the rise has resumed and I believe now is accelerating. So it's a sort of pattern of stop and start.
The rise that was occurring before the stable period, what do we know about what was causing it then?
This is really, I think, more in Andrew's area than mine. But what was going on was that the Ice Age was ending. There was widespread global warming. There was extensive melting of the ice sheets which covered North America and covered Scandinavia and elsewhere. And sea levels began to rise with this discharge of meltwater into the ocean. And then you also got very complex and little understood adjustments of the Earth's crust going on, which varied considerably from one area to another. And the result was that the geography of much of the world changed. I mean, Scandinavia and Alaska were separated. The continental shelf that practically joined Southeast Asia to Australia was vanished underwater. You've got the North Sea was flooded by 5500 BC. England was separated from the Channel and so on. There were very, very radical changes. This apart from changes in vegetation and so on. But the shifts in recent years have been, quite dramatic. What is going on at the moment, I'm told, is a little more cooling than usual. So the point about climate change and all these things is that they're not regular. They vary tremendously. And you get cycles where not much happened, then you get a cycle where things happened. And this is true of all climate change.
Andrea Dutton, let's bring you in. Now, you've also looked back as far as the Ice Age. Why do we start there?
What we were just talking about, coming out of this last Ice Age, this is a time period when you had large ice sheets covering vast portions of the Northern Hemisphere. And as we were just talking about, those ice sheets retreated and sea level rose. And then it stabilized somewhat. So when we're talking about sea level change, and particularly looking into the future, we don't actually really want to be thinking about the changes that happened between the Ice Age and today. That was a very different dynamic of these ice sheets over these large continents in the Northern Hemisphere. What we really want to understand now is what's happening to these large polar ice sheets that we still have in Greenland and Antarctica, and what's going to happen to them as we go into the future. So that's the reason my research actually focuses on periods of time in the past that are warm periods when we had ice sheets in a similar configuration to today, so meaning ice on Greenland and Antarctica, to understand how sensitive those ice sheets are to changes in temperature.
I suppose that is what you meant by radiative forcing?
Yes. So one of the main drivers, of course, is how much of the sun's energy is coming into the Earth at a given time. And so one of the periods that I study is called the last interglacial. So that's before the last ice age, when sea levels were higher than today. But the temperatures were pretty similar, but a few degrees warmer at the poles. And one difference back then is that the Northern Hemisphere was receiving a lot more solar radiation during the summertime, which we think had something to do with the warmer temperatures there. What we're looking at today, though, is a very different scenario. So what's driving the climate change? The changes are, for one thing, happening much faster. Temperature is changing much faster. And the forcing in terms of the increase in temperature is global scale. It's not focused just in the northern hemisphere. The increase in CO2 in our atmosphere is causing the entire globe to warm.
Brian Fagan?
I agree with that. I mean, she's dealing with a whole new generation of research, which is very exciting. And the point is, you can't look at climate change except globally, and we tended to focus on the northern hemisphere.
You actually opened your book with these storms that are occurring, particularly with Katrina and Sandy, and how massive they have become and more frequent they have become. How are these things related? How come climate change translates into these storms, and how is that all related to sea level?
The most important thing about rising sea levels and extreme weather events, and I believe the climatologists, and Jim, they know more about this than I do, are forecasting that there were going to be, or predicting there were going to be many more severe events. The big real threat, human-wise, is obviously strong winds and so on, but it is the sea surges which accompany these and which inundate densely populated coastal areas, of which, of course, New Jersey is one. The real serious problem in the immediate future is Bangladesh, which is, as you know, very prone to cyclones. And this whole area, which lies very close to sea level, has very dense populations in the millions. And the effects of this mean that millions of people are basically losing their land permanently in the long term, apart from the dangers of contamination of groundwater and so on. And we're going to be facing an issue of environmental refugees, which is going to get very serious globally, I think.
You actually mentioned a few other places in the book in addition to Bangladesh. You talked about the Pacific Islands. You mentioned the Bahamas. You mentioned Vietnam. What is the scope as a big problem for issues of climate refugees?
The big issue is acceptance. For example, if you take Bangladesh, and let's say, just for the sake of argument, they need to move 10 million people, where are they going to go? They're not going to go to Myanmar, and Myanmar doesn't want them. India doesn't want them. Apart from political and social stresses, they have serious problems themselves. And the only alternative is to develop international policies which deal with a very, very difficult problem, which is the moving of subsistence farmers who have very close emotional relationships to their land into countries that will accept them where they have no skills which are useful in the modern industrial economy. And this is a very, very serious problem because it intersects problems in every single nation and areas like South Dakota, where I'm sitting, which are hundreds of miles from the ocean, because where are people going to go?
And there's also vulnerable parts in the U.S. you mentioned. You said it was concentrated in the South.
Mainly in the South because of the nature of the shoreline and the just the geology and so on. And the parts of the East are very vulnerable. The West Coast is not quite so bad. But the real, real problem areas beyond the Arctic, obviously, are places like Shanghai, low-lying areas where there really are millions of people in the way in urban environments, and you have the option. Do you wall them off or at vast expense, or do you pay the bills when it happens and people die or whatever? And these are very serious problems which are going to come home to roost more and more, I think, in the next century.
Andrea Dutton, let's bring you back in here. It sounded like the work that you're doing suggests that the average global sea level can rise 20 to 30 feet?
Yes, that's right. So this time period I mentioned before, the last interglacial, where it was only a couple degrees warmer at the poles, what we've done is we've gone back and looked at what elevation we can find fossil corals. So corals grow close to the sea surface, and that's one method we can use to reconstruct where sea level was in the past. So a lot of the sites that I go to, you can see these corals sticking way above sea level now. And we've determined that the peak sea level during this time period was probably between about 5.5 to 9 meters above present sea level. So that's something like 18 to almost 30 feet.
Do we have a sense of how soon that will happen?
That is the multi-billion dollar question, right? We know that sea level rise is inevitable in our future. And so what we want to know, what everyone wants to know, is how much, and in particular, how quickly is that going to happen? That's a very difficult question to answer because the models that we have about the physics of how these ice sheets will respond dynamically like this are basically not good enough for us to do good projections into the future. And that's why I've taken the approach of looking into the past, and we're trying to determine when these things happen, when do ice sheets collapse, and how quickly does that happen. At this stage, we can't tell you how quickly. We know that it obviously takes some time. So as you warm the Earth's atmosphere, it will take some time for the ice sheets to respond. But a lot of the research that's come out, even I'd say in the last decade, is really pointing us towards thinking that the ice sheets can respond a lot quicker than we used to think they could. So it's not going to happen overnight. You're not going to get 30 feet of sea level rise, right? But the point I like to make to people is you really have to start to think about what commitment are we making to sea level rise? Because if we warm the atmosphere by, you know, a couple degrees at the poles, we're going to cross that within a matter of decades, right? So we may be committing ourselves to this type of sea level rise in the future for the future generations.
If we look into history, sometimes it's a good predictor, sometimes it's not a good predictor to the future. What can we look at historically that might give us some guidance, Brian Fagan?
Practically nothing. I mean, as Andrew's pointed out, and this is really important research they're doing, I mean, they're really attacking the million-dollar question. The basic variable is there were just so many people, and there was no precedent that really would tell you how people will react and what we can do. We're really on our own, in my humble opinion.
Andrea?
So historically, there actually is a lot we can learn, not necessarily about what's going to happen, but what has happened tells us a lot about the system. So if we look at, there are sea level records that have been generated over, say, the past 2,000 years in great detail, looking at salt marsh sediments. And what they tell us is that for most of that 2,000 years, there were pretty minor changes in sea level. But in the late 1800s, that sea level started to rise dramatically, just about the same time as temperature rose dramatically due to industrialization and putting CO2 into the atmosphere. So what we can say is this type of sea level rise within the past 2,000 years is unprecedented, right? So we can see there's this really rapid response of sea level to changes in temperatures, and that's an important thing we can take away from the historical record.
Yeah, but it's a fairly shallow historical record by my standards, but she's absolutely right. This is very, very important.
Brian Fagan, would you say, since you're kind of looking at this from the big picture of what are we going to do as a humanity, would you say that primarily what people have to do now is start planning to adjust?
Yes. I think a number of things got to happen. I think one of them is that we've really got to start thinking about this. It's a political issue. It's a very complex economic and social issue. And we really need to start planning. The problem is that our whole system and life is set up for short-term thinking. And this is a problem for our great-grandchildren. About the only people who are thinking about this in the long term that I know of are the Dutch. And they're planning for, Andrew may know the figure, but I think it's 100,000-year events, something like that. And that's a very long feeling. And even them, I know, are having some resistance from the present generation. Why should we pay for this? And things like that. These are the sort of issues which are going to become more and more prevalent as this situation intensifies. But at the moment, there is no serious thinking about it in most countries in the world.
Andrea Dutton, where do you see the future of your research with what you've now discovered?
It's pretty clear to us that during this last interglacial period that the West Antarctic ice sheet pretty much collapsed. So large portions of this ice sheet are currently grounded below sea level. So it can be pretty sensitive to warming ocean waters from underneath the ice shelf, and it can retreat very rapidly. So we're pretty sure that this collapsed during that time period, and we're debating about when it happened, under what conditions, and how quickly. So this is one of the directions that we're moving into, and we're trying to understand, you know, did sea level rise gradually, or was it very rapid? Is it kind of a nonlinear response? Those are the types of things that are going to be really important knowledge to have as we move into the future.
When I tell you I've spent the last 2 years looking about ancient animals, you will understand. What Andrew's doing is of enormous importance, because what they're addressing, they're using the remote past, the recent past, to look at what might happen. And they're doing it in very realistic terms, which is scientifically intelligible to a wide audience. And this, to me, is enormously important.
Well, thank you both so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Thank you for having me.
Andrea Dutton is a professor in the Department of Geological Sciences at the University of Florida. She is the author of Ice Volumes and Sea Level During the Last Interglacial that was published in the journal Science. Brian Fagan is an emeritus professor of anthropology at the University of California, Santa Barbara. He's the author of more than 40 books, including his latest, The Attacking Ocean, The Past, Present, and Future of Rising Sea Levels. When we come back, the science of addiction. Stay tuned.
Blackbird singing in the dead of night. Take these sunken eyes and learn to see all your life. You were only waiting for this moment to be free. Blackbird fly.
This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org, and I'm Maria Armudian. What exactly is addiction, and how should it be addressed? Our next panel suggests that science and evidence are debunking many long-held societal myths on the matter. Lance Dodis is former clinical professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School. He is the author of The Heart of Addiction, Breaking Addiction, and his latest, The Sober Truth, Debunking the Bad Science Behind 12-Step Programs in the Rehab Industry. Jeffrey Foote is co-founder and executive director of the Center for Motivation and Change. He was previously senior research associate at Columbia University and deputy director of alcohol treatment and research at Mount Sinai Medical Center. He is the co-author of Beyond Addiction, How Science and Kindness Help People Change. Adi Jaffe is a lecturer at UCLA and director of research, education, and innovation at Alternatives Addiction Treatment. Welcome to the Scholar Circle. I'd like to start with the essential definition and scope of addiction. Seems somewhat contested. What exactly is addiction? What does it mean to have an addiction? And who exactly does this affect? Lance Dodis, what have you found?
I think it's quite important to understand that the word itself has been confusing, that it's used in several different ways, which overlap, but they're different. And part of the reason that there is controversy about what is an addiction, I believe, is because the word is used in several ways and it's not clear. So what I would say is this. The first way the word is used is to describe physical addiction, physical dependency. That's a pretty simple, serious, but simple medical condition in which certain drugs are reacted to by people's bodies, so they become tolerant to it, so they can take more of the same drug and not have a reaction. As a consequence, they tend to take more and more drug to get the same reaction they did to begin with. And then once you become tolerant to it, that is, you need more dose of it, once that happens, then if you take away the drug, you have a reaction because your body is used to its presence. That's the withdrawal reaction. So tolerance and withdrawal together define physical addiction. So that's one way the word is used, and it's often confused with the other kinds. A second way in which the word is used, incorrectly in my opinion, is the way that's been defined by the neurobiological research on rats. That kind of addiction has to do with the fact that in rats and in people, if you are exposed to high doses of a drug like heroin over a long period of time, the tolerance you develop is actually caused by a brain change. The specific change is that you respond more, you have an upregulation, you have a greater response to subsequent exposure to the heroin. And that's a change in the brain which continues so that when rats are exposed to cues that were associated with the original giving of the drug, then they get excited because the neurotransmitter dopamine is released in the reward pathway. That's true, and you can find some similar changes in humans if you do an fMRI. But the problem with it is that's not anything like human addiction. It's a real phenomenon. And if you are an alcoholic and you walk into a bar, that's probably a bad idea because, yes, you may very well get stimulated. But that's very different from the problem of addiction. The real problem with addiction isn't physical addiction, which we can cure easily by detoxing somebody, nor is it this kind of instant excitement. The problem is people get detoxed, and we all know that doesn't cure their addiction. And a week, a year, 2 years later, they may go back to doing the same behavior, take a drug or do another addictive behavior, and it's precipitated by something emotional. The fact that we can, humans, substitute drug addictions for non-drug addictions is very telling. If the chronic brain disease theory applied to humans, that wouldn't work. Also, about 40 years ago, a woman named Robbins out of Washington University in St. Louis did a famous study in which she looked at Vietnam soldiers who were addicted to heroin. People were worried about whether they would ever be able to get off heroin. That's actually when the term hooked on drugs began, the late 60s, because heroin addicts in the United States were unable to get off. They would go into a detox. They would be successfully detoxified from heroin, so they'd no longer had a physical addiction, but they'd go right back out and use heroin again. So people were worried about what would happen when the soldiers came home. They were also addicted to heroin. So they were detoxed, and what Robbins and her group did was she followed them up later. And what she found was extremely significant. She found that over 90% of them never used or became addicted to heroin again. So this was an unexpected finding. And the only way to explain it was that there was something different about the people. The drug was the same in Vietnam and the United States, but the people were different. The difference was the soldiers had used heroin because they were in Vietnam. It was a terrible environment, and they used it because of that. But inside of them, psychologically, emotionally, they didn't need to have an addiction. And when they left that terrible environment, they didn't. The stateside addicts used heroin because they were addicts, whatever that means. To me, it meant that they had a psychological system which used a compulsive behavior to solve their distress. That's what addiction is. Detoxing them just didn't do any good. So that brings us to the final meaning of addiction, which is addiction is not more or less than a psychological compulsion. Yes, it's more serious. Yes, it's deadly. And it looks different in some ways. But addiction has really nothing to do with drugs, as we know, because people with drug addictions can shift to non-drug addictive behavior like compulsive gambling or compulsive shopping, and then they may shift back again. But we also know that addictive episodes occur because of psychological distress, something that's not true in rats. And people don't look like rats when they decide to do an addictive behavior. An example I've often used is a man who is sitting at his desk at 1 o'clock in the afternoon, and he is upset by something, and he's an alcoholic who hasn't been drinking. But now he says, damn it, I'm going to have a drink when I go home. And he does, but that's 4 hours later. And in the meantime, he's not running around. He's not stimulated by the release of dopamine. In fact, in humans, it's usually quite the reverse. People become calm once they've decided to seek their addictive activity, whatever it is, a drug or another activity. And they're able to wait. People drive 2 hours to a casino, for example, and they're calm as long as they're on the way. So it doesn't have to do with a change in their brain. It doesn't have to do with cues. And it has everything to do with solving a psychological state of distress. It does get confusing because the same people with a physical addiction may also have a true addiction, a psychological addiction. And they also may get triggered when they walk into a bar. But they're really entirely separate things.
Jeffrey Foote, would you agree?
I would agree with a lot of what Dr. Doe has just described. I think I'd like to take it from a slightly different angle, related angle, but a different way of thinking about it. We just wrote a book for families and trying to help them think about addiction. And one of the things you come up against in trying to help families and trying to help families in this culture is that we all want a one-size-fits-all black and white definition. And it becomes, unfortunately, a somewhat destructive process because there are a variety of labels in the culture, as Dr. Dodis was pointing out, which can mean lots of different things. You really could define this in different ways. We could have all sorts of arguments about the merits of those different definitions. And unfortunately, what happens is that the people we're trying to help in these ways get lost in those definitions and in that language. The phenomenology, really, on the ground is people get into these difficulties with substances in all sorts of different ways, from all sorts of different trajectories, and get out of it in all sorts of different ways. And with help, without help, with epiphanies, without epiphanies, And to be able to recognize that diversity, I think, is incredibly important, as opposed to having a definition that can describe the entire phenomenon perfectly. And the need or the push for a description in that sense, I think, has been closely tied with stigma and with the use of language that's very stigmatizing. So even the descriptions of people as addicts, and I deal with clients all day long who describe themselves as addicts, and sometimes that's a helpful definition, and sometimes that's a definition that really has not much to do with who they actually are, but they've adopted it because of the culture they're in. So I think the approach that we've taken on a therapeutic level and working with families level is the definition doesn't matter. What actually matters is how is this impacting your life? How significantly is it impacting your life? How significantly is it impacting your loved one's life? And what are the strategies we can use to help you get out of this? Because if we sort of help them with this idea that we need to define this and fit everybody into the same category, we're just missing huge numbers of people. People, they're gonna, usually are giving people the examples of, you know, your husband started to have this problem because he came back from Iraq and multiple colleagues and friends and buddies got blown up and it was horrible and he has PTSD and that's why he's using alcohol to the extent that he's using it. And someone else is, you know, using alcohol the way they're using it because they started drinking when they were 13 and their father is alcohol dependent and there's a much heftier genetic component to their use. And someone else started drinking when their wife passed away, and they've been grieving for a year, and they've never talked about it, and they don't know what to do with themselves every night. Those are all very different people. They all have significant substance problems. We can try to define them by the term addiction, but it's not going to help us so much in helping them. So it's a different perspective in terms of how to think about it in a practical way.
Adi Jaffe, what would you add to this?
I could spend 30 minutes just talking about Dr. Dota's definition. Hopefully we'll kind of get back to it, but I love Dr. Foote's assertion that any attempt to lump all addiction, all addictive behavior into one category or another is going to leave us wanting, because addiction develops in different ways. It develops to different substances in different ways. And while to a large extent psychological distress, or as Dr. Dotis had pointed out, plays a role in it, suggesting that all ways of addressing psychological distress are the same, and that because the syndrome looks the same at the end, it should have a similar ideology or a similar development trajectory, I think, can leave us looking at a problem a little bit more simply. I look at our clients, and in the same way as Dr. Foote had just pointed out, we really look at our clients and people who develop substance use issues in as much of a label-free sort of environment as possible. And I agree that although some people feel like the addict label actually empowers them, while other people feel...
I think we just lost Adi Jaffe, but we'll get him back. Dr. Dotis, one of the aspects that you've talked about is this sense of helplessness.
Actually, this follows nicely from what Adi Jaffe was saying and Dr. Foote, that there are many different ways that addiction looks. Somebody has PTSD and then develops an addiction. Somebody loses someone important in his life and then develops an addiction. What's important about that is that there is a commonality there, and it is different. Each person is triggered by something that is especially important to that person. But the commonality is that in every case, there's a sense of being trapped or overwhelmingly helpless. For one person, it might be the loss of a loved one. For another person, it might be the loss of something that is important to their self-esteem. There are an almost unlimited number of things like that. But what is a precipitant for one person won't matter to another person. It's another way of saying that when you treat addiction, it has to be individualized treatment. One-size-fits-all programs just are senseless. So I think that the best way to treat people, since this is so essential to the cause of addiction rather than the results, which look different, to the things that precipitate addiction, is to help people to know what in them is so overwhelming. And typically for people, there are things that are always overwhelming for them, the same things over and over again. The superficial form may vary, but the bottom line is that the sort of things that trigger overwhelming helplessness that lead people to have an urge to do a compulsive or addictive behavior, those things are also always the same things that are the most important issues for them emotionally. Addiction is not separate from the rest of a person's psyche, and when you treat addiction, it's very important to understand that you're treating the whole person. You're treating the person's emotional life, of which the addiction is a powerful and important symptom.
Jeffrey Foote, let's talk for a moment about these family dynamics that you've written about in your book Beyond Addiction, How Science and Kindness Help People Change. It seems like the entire book is geared toward the family members of a person who is wrestling with the substance. Why did you address the book to the family members, and what is the impact of that dynamic?
Several reasons. One is that if you just took the United States, the number of people who are struggling with substance issues is enormous. If you're just looking at diagnostic criteria, the number of people who are meeting criteria are measured in the 20 million plus. And then there's estimates about the number of people who are impacted by each one of those people. You know, 4 to 5 people are closely impacted by that level of substance problem. So there's a lot going on in terms of the number of people who are affected. What we also know is that family pressure, whether it's positive or negative or whatever it is the leading cause of people seeking treatment. And we also know that families are suffering from these issues. So independently, you could just make the case they really need help. And last, and sort of on a practical level, families are also the ones with the most contact. So even just on the level of if your goal is to help the person who's struggling with substances, you would be wise to be helping their family understand these issues and understand how to help in a more effective way. And, you know, I'm a psychologist, and I see someone twice a week, 5 times a week, in groups, in individual, whatever it is. You know, they're 160, 170 hours in a week. It's not a lot, and their family is around them a lot. So just as a vehicle of change, you're theoretically harnessing a much more powerful group than just their individual or group therapy situation, or just their sponsor at AA, or just sole individuals who have less contact with them. The book is written for families. It's a description of treatment and navigating the treatment system, which is quite a thing to navigate in this country and quite nightmarish, actually. Also outlining us in very great detail a number of strategies which come from an approach called CRAFT, which is community reinforcement and family training. It's just been a very successful motivational and behavioral approach for families. And in psychosocial research, you don't get huge differences between treatment approaches. I remember the first time I saw a presentation of the data on CRAFT, I was walking in a conference. I was wandering away from my own poster and looked at a poster someone was presenting about CRAFT. And I looked at it and I thought, okay, they must have made up the data, because it was ridiculously positive. By which I mean, in the 8 or 10 or 12 controlled studies that have been done with CRAFT, when you train a family in this way with these strategies, the engagement rates of their loved one who's struggling are in the 65 to 75% range. And the other interventions that are commonly used, which are suggestions to go to Al-Anon, which would be probably the biggest one, or do an intervention, which would be the most dramatic and popular one on TV, have incredibly low engagement rates when you actually compare apples to apples in controlled trials. You know, Al-Anon is not geared towards engaging families, towards engaging the loved one who's struggling. So that's not an apples-to-apples comparison, but it's a common referral, so it's an important one to look at. And interventions are meant to engage people, and they typically engage between 0 and 30% of the people, which is not a great outcome. So we wrote the book for families because this approach is incredibly helpful and incredibly effective, and because families just don't know what to do. And you're talking about a group of highly motivated, highly distressed people who are getting all kinds of suggestions about how to help that typically are not great. They're highly vulnerable to suggestions because they're so distressed, and they don't have appropriate tools to use.
Just a reminder that you're listening to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian, and we're talking about the science of addiction. The one piece that you didn't address is that family dynamics can actually make the substance worse, or can help the person wrestling with the substance pursue a more healthy path.
Just on a behavioral level, one of the things that happens is that naturally enough, when there's behavior that's going on that's destructive, and dealing with substance misuse is an arena in which people are, because of the culture we live in and because of the shame involved and it's a stigmatized problem and so forth, people are doing antisocial behaviors around that, and they're lying, and they're, you know, taking money, and they're breaching the social fabric in ways that don't go well in families and in other settings. So they go underground and they lie about it and they don't tell people what's going on. And that's very fractious in a family. It's very painful, and family members are suffering and they feel betrayed. And the cycle that typically can ensue from that is a very negative cycle. And communication breaks down and becomes very negative or very shut down. So just as purely on a behavioral level, if you think about what could be different, if you train people in a variety of strategies, beginning with just communication strategies, how can you address this differently? How can you approach your loved one in a different way that doesn't produce the same negative spiral every time? How can you step away from fractious, difficult interactions that are just going to result in fighting? How do you reward positive behaviors instead of just focusing on the negative ones, which naturally enough you're very attuned to, but can you pull yourself away from that and try to reward some of the positive behaviors you're seeing also? Those are behavioral descriptions of how you change the dynamics, so to speak, in a family. And you're really just working interactionally to change the whole milieu in that family. And it has a very dramatic effect, actually.
Adi Jaffe, yeah, I think we lost you there for a bit.
I agree with Dr. Foote that while we might address it using different language, I think nobody would deny that family environment plays a significant role in this equation. And, you know, I think one of the roles that I'm probably playing in this trio has to do with the behavioral neuroscience sort of approach of looking at some of these things. And I think that while not everything can be explained by the neuroscientific component of it, a lot of the components that we're talking about are also relevant. And so, for instance, with family members, oftentimes we talk about the fact that while clients might have cues and triggers that have become associated with using, family members have triggers that come up for them all the time. And while for our target client, the triggers might bring up desires to use or desires to escape, for their family members, the triggers might bring up discomfort, anxiety, reactive behavior, and things of that nature that also need to be addressed, because if they continue to act in that way, it can continue to produce a sort of contentious environment that is not supportive of recovery in whatever form a person decides to explore it. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the reasons that that can serve such an important role in this overall equation is because, you know, Dr. Dodis was talking about the kind of learning that might have happened, people leaving environments like Vietnam, vets leaving Vietnam and not becoming addicted. And we know that there's such a thing as context-specific learning. So people and animals, including those rats, will learn to use in one context, and then you take them to another context, and all of a sudden it looked like they didn't learn to use at all. And that is important also within the context of a family, because we deal with clients all the time when the stress of family interaction is not a big part of their life for a moment, and all of a sudden their use goes down and everything seems to get better. And the family that is actually trying to help might be doing so in ways that are actually harmful to the overall recovery process. It might be triggering stress, again, what Dr. Dodis would be calling psychological distress, and triggering increases in use. And, you know, no matter what language we use, I think the entire system surrounding the environment, including the work environment, educational environment, legal environment, policy, and the familial environment have to be taken into account when you look at a problem like this.
Let's turn to things that work and things that don't. Lance Dodis, your book that's just coming out is called The Sober Truth, Debunking the Bad Science Between 12-Step Programs and the Rehab Industry. That's pretty damning. You've been very critical of both of these. Haven't they been successful for some people? And what do you find that's so lacking?
There are just some simple facts which tell the tale. If you look at the people who go to AA and then you figure out how many of them become sober members, that number is between 5 and 10%. That's just the fact. So AA and its brethren, other anonymous organizations, 12-step programs, are among the least successful in medicine. But, of course, some people are helped. And I've been interested for years in understanding why anybody is helped by their approach. So if you look at the science behind 12-step programs, and there have been many, many studies in the scientific literature, in 2006, the Cochrane Collaboration, which is a very highly esteemed group that looks at all scientific studies to decide which are valid, did a review of the previous 40 years of research on AA, and they concluded that there was simply no evidence that AA was effective at all. Partly that may be because the spontaneous remission rate actually for alcoholism is roughly the same as the success rate of AA. But if you look at studies since then as well, what we found and what we wrote, spent a lot of time on in the book, is the multiple errors in these studies that make their conclusions simply unjustifiable. These are scientific errors. This is not a matter of opinion. I won't go into all of them, but one of the biggest things is that the way it works in AA is, or in 12-step programs, is the majority of people always drop out if you wait long enough. AA itself says that only about 25% of people stay after 1 year. But the studies don't include that data. In one study, for example, it followed people for 16 years. They drew conclusions about the usefulness of continuing in AA, but 83% of their patients had dropped out. And they acknowledged something we all know, that the dropouts are the people who are doing the worst. So when you don't include that data, you're looking at a tautology. You're saying the people who did well and stayed in because they were doing well, did well. People who do well, do well. That says nothing about the effectiveness of AA as an organization for the general population. There's a lot more, but I'll stop there. Now, the rehabs have an additional problem. Almost every rehab in this country is 12-step based, and they're proud of it. You go to their sites, Betty Ford says, we are a 12-step based program. Hazelden says, we are a 12-step program, and so forth. So you start out with the idea that these are programs that are based on this statistically highly ineffective treatment. But then they take this treatment, which you can get for free in a church basement, and they charge a fortune. So if you're going to spend $30,000 to $90,000 a month, which is mostly the range, what are you getting for that? It turns out that besides AA, you're getting extremely little at most of them. Some are better than others. But we published in the book the daily schedule of a couple of these programs like Betty Ford and Hazelden, and they have a lot of stuff which the kindest thing you can say is that they're not useful. You could say other things too. For example, they have horse therapy. A number of the higher-end places use horses as a treatment for addiction. They have people that they call equine therapists. To my knowledge, there is no evidence that being around a horse helps with addiction, and of course it makes no sense. Why do they have these things? They have them because since none of them are doing very well helping people, they are in competition with each other, so they had, over the years, to develop other ways of attracting people. So they added more and more high-end pseudo-treatments. Almost all of them talk about how beautiful their setting is. They're in rolling hills. They have gourmet food. One of them, Passages Malibu, gives you a trip on a yacht. And by the way, the ship is called the Safe Passage. And the rationale is this will give you a taste of what life will be like when you're sober. So
they call it yacht therapy, by the way. Sorry, this is a DJaffe.
Yeah, yacht therapy, right. So this is the kind of nonsense that's going on. And it's terrible for two reasons. One is that for both 12-step programs and for these fancy rehabs, they're wasting people's time. We all know of cases where people have gone for years and decades to AA and have not done well. AA, unfortunately, never says, we're not right for you. We are a program that is just not right for you. Do something else. I have been talking to alcoholics for 40 years. I have never heard someone say that AA ever told them that, because AA is never wrong. If you fail, that means you failed. The program never fails. And unfortunately, the same attitude prevails in the rehabs. They never fail. When you hear these celebrities going in and out of these programs 10 or 12 times, no one says the program must be no good. They say the person has failed. So there's a tremendous loss of time, and there's a tremendous sense of failure that people have when they don't do well. The bottom line is the rehabs really should be grossly changed, massively changed. You can do a much better rehab for much less money by leaving out the nonsense and doing something that's better. But the bigger problem is almost everybody in this country, when someone comes into their office as a patient and says, I have an addiction, they're told, go to a 12-step program. And given the statistic, that's the wrong advice 90% of the time. So it's not that AA shouldn't exist, but we should understand who benefits and who doesn't, and then triage them. If you're sending more than, 10 or 15% of all the people who come into your office to AA, you're doing the wrong thing.
Adi Jaffe?
I couldn't agree more with Dr. Dodis on not only the statistics on traditional treatment, but also the ridiculous nature of the industry itself sometimes. When we set up alternatives, it actually came from my 12 years of research at UCLA looking at addiction treatment, looking at these horrible statistics on an ongoing basis. I was not interested in clinical work at all when I started doing research. But what ended up happening is, while I thought initially that we just didn't know enough about how to treat people better, I was mistaken. And after 12 years of research, when I started seeing all the data supporting all these alternative methodologies like CRAFT and motivational interviewing and obviously CBT and medication and assisted therapy, all these different things that existed and had an evidence base behind them but just were not adopted, I just decided to really sort of leave the academic part of it and say, I need to do something about this and go and provide a treatment that really just depends on those services that have an evidence base behind them. I think it's a huge disservice to essentially let 99% of the industry be controlled by a treatment paradigm that is not helpful for more than 10 to 15 to 20%, depending, again, on who you talk to. But I agree in terms of the intent-to-treat sort of analysis stuff that Dr. Dodis was talking about, that numbers can be inflated as you get them higher. There's a range of useful treatments, and while AA fits into that category, what I tell all of our clients is, just like a carpenter carries around a set of tools, it's not that a hammer is a bad tool, and if we equate AA, let's say, to the hammer in this example, it's not that a hammer is a bad tool, but if I have a bolt, a hammer is completely useless. And if we start looking at all of our clients as nails, then we're doing them a disservice, and we're not helping them treat underlying issues. You know, we know for a fact that addiction comes along with trauma. It comes along with co-occurring disorders. AA does nothing to help treat any of those, and there's nothing within AA that specifically suggests that people seek treatment for other things. If they, by some chance, have a good sponsor or meet people who know what they're talking about within the system, then they would get directed towards it. But the system by itself, the 12 steps, don't correct underlying disorders. And for people like that who are using substances because of distress to correct some, whether you want to call it a chemical imbalance or environmental influences or early trauma, just taking away their drug, just taking away the substance that is making their life tolerable, is not going to make their life better. And at times can actually make it significantly worse and can be irresponsible. Dr. Mark Kern, who's the co-founder here at Alternatives, fought heavily to get Smart Recovery, which is a CBT-based self-help group, and Moderation Management, which is a non-abstinence-based self-help group, included in the California register of what are acceptable self-help sort of modalities for people to pursue when they get in trouble with the law. Because for a while, at least in California, but I know it's this way across the United States, AA was the thing that judges sent you to with a 10 or so percent success rate in the long term. And we have to move away from an industry that is so unitarily incapable of helping the clients that they seek out. I think we have to get better at, as Dr. Dodis suggested, triaging. There's been research trying to predict who's going to fit what sort of treatment. And to the best of my knowledge, we're not really good at being able to predict that. But I think we need to start offering a menu. And when people start saying, I'm having troubles with substances, we should say, okay, well, there's CBT or MI-based treatment. There is abstinence and non-abstinence-based treatment, depending on what their level of severity and physical distress. Some would be a better fit than others. And, you know, one of the biggest pieces of evidence that I saw that made me leave academia was the fact that if you want to know what treatment is going to be the best fit for somebody, ask them what treatment they want to engage in. If you let them select, they're more likely to engage, they're more likely to attend, and they're more likely to be successful doing it. But we don't do that to people now. We direct them. And when we direct people to a treatment modality that is not all that successful to start out with, we see the horrible success rates that we see in the industry.
Jeffrey Foote.
I'll add this. While I'm sitting at our rehab that we opened 2 weeks ago, and that's just to start the discussion about rehabs again, I absolutely, with the nature of what is being said about 12-step involvement in its current usage in this country, which is, by the way, quite different in other countries. The last point that Dr. Jaffe was making also is incredibly important, and it goes back to the first part of this discussion about what is addiction and how do you define it, which is the issue of collaboration. People get into this in all kinds of different ways, and to just dictate to them what is going to be the, quote, cure or the way out of this is to kind of override the fact that people are very different in what addiction, what substance issues mean to them, how they got there, and so forth. The only effective treatment is going to be individualized care. And that's another way of saying you have to collaborate with your clients. You have to ask them. You have to get buy-in, which is sort of a principal component of motivational approaches, is we need to have buy-in. We need to be collaborating on what we're doing here. Otherwise, there's nothing sustainable. And that is an evidence-based principle of change beyond addiction, found in all sorts of change processes, that it needs to make sense to the person. They need to endorse it. It needs to mean something to them personally for it to be a sustainable change. And when you're talking about an issue like this that's often a multi-year struggle for people, it being sustainable, it being something that they bought into, the change process, is critical. The only thing I would say, it's not particularly a contrary point to the AA point that's being made. The framing I have, which is, I think, similar to Dr. Jaffe, is that the provision of choice is also a principle that has been extracted from a lot of research as critical to effective change. So in that spirit, in that vein, clinically the way we discuss this with clients, and I think philosophically and scientifically the way you would need to discuss it with clients is, it's another option. And it may be an option that's helpful to you. And it's something to try, and it's ubiquitous in the culture, so you might as well, and it's free, so you might as well. And if it's helpful to you, it's helpful to you. That's literally what we say to our clients. If it's not helpful to you, it's not helpful to you, and there's no reason to keep going, and there's no reason to get ensnared in some sort of self-perpetuating sense of, I'm the one who's screwing up because AA is not helping me. So give yourself permission to use it if it's helpful, and give yourself permission to not use it if it's not. But I wouldn't take it off the table as anathema in some way. It's just another option. Ultimately, the provision of options is what's going to help people change. So
let's end this with a look at public policy. Lance Dodis has said to me, and Adi Jaffe, you just mentioned the mandated part of, say, courts sending people to AA. So let's turn for a second to, given the science base, the evidence base of what works with addiction, and given the scope of the problem of addiction, what should policymakers know? What are the implications for policy from this point forward? Lance Dodis?
I just wanted to add to Dr. Jaffe's point. It's not only terrible that the courts are doing it, but it actually has been declared unconstitutional to refer people to AA in something like 20-plus states. And the reason it's unconstitutional is because it violates the Freedom of Religion Clause of the Constitution, because the courts have found that AA is a religious organization, so you can't very well send people to it. But as far as public policy goes, what I would like to see is a much more open, accepting, questioning attitude toward treatment. I agree with what people are saying. I think certainly you have to have a treatment that is simply imposed and doesn't involve the consent and whatever degree of enthusiasm from the patient is foolish. But we should be open to many things, and I think that's fine. My only objection to calling it evidence-based, because that is, of course, the thing these days, everything is supposed to be evidence-based, I have a problem with it. And my problem with it is just like what we were talking about in The Sober Truth in our book. The evidence in evidence-based is usually pretty bad. So I am extremely cautious about using so-called evidence, because it's very, very hard to get good evidence that is really meaningful on things that can be measured. Plus, as someone once said, not everything that can be measured is important, and not everything that's important can be measured. And that's nowhere more true than in people's emotional lives. If somebody comes out of a therapy and they are now able to stand in a room with other people without having being frightened of the intimacy of being close to someone, what number do we assign to that? There is no way to measure in statistical outcomes what is done in a good therapy or when people really work out their problems. The other thing I would suggest for public policy is that we train our leaders to stop thinking in mechanistic terms and start thinking about this as a problem that should be understood first, and treatment should follow understanding.
Jeffrey Foote?
Couple thoughts. One is the struggle over what evidence-based means has been ongoing for a while now. I would generally be a huge proponent of the concept of evidence-based. We claim to be an evidence-based treatment program. We've been around for 10 years in New York City, and sadly, I think we're still one of the few places that's still a niche market to be an evidence-based treatment program. I don't actually think it's a meaningless concept. I absolutely grant the point that there are treatment modalities, psychodynamic treatments, that are more difficult to modularize, and that's one of the standards of how you collect evidence. So you've sort of markedly put several treatment protocols at disadvantages because they're not easily standardized. That's a whole discussion about how you even collect evidence, and I agree it's a messy affair. But I don't think it's a meaningless concept. It's a far better world than the one where we just are ideologically driven, or as many states are now doing about evidence-based treatments, they're just voting on what we think are evidence-based treatments. And anybody can throw anything into the hat and just shout loud enough, and that's going to be an evidence-based treatment, which is sort of the horrifying other side of this discussion. So there does need to be some work on clarifying what evidence-based means.
Adi Jaffe.
I love the fact that we have to clarify that evidence-based treatments mean that there's an evidence base for them. But I'll concede the point that maybe we moved away from that to some extent. I think that overall, we need to move to a point where something that we're actually trying to affect here in California, where the policy is such that treatments that have an evidence base are incorporated as the first path. And along the lines of what Dr. Dodis had mentioned, I think one of the things that we really need to look at is how does the current policy affect drug users broadly? And then what does it do to the ones who get in trouble with substances? Because I think, you know, the criminalization of substance use in this country, if you look at the history of drug use, essentially what it's done is not necessarily ever reduce problematic use. It might reduce general use in the society, but people seem to move towards things that alter their state of being to some extent. When prohibition went into effect, marijuana use increased in this country. And when we made opiates illegal, it's not that people stopped using them, it's just that it went into a black market and problematic use became more of a socioeconomic sort of condition. I think we need to get and figure out some sort of policy that makes sense in terms of not alienating people due to the use of substances and you know, sort of being beholden to one or two substances that we feel like are okay. And by the way, the, you know, something along the lines of 70 to 80% of people who seek treatment seek it for alcohol, which is the legal substance that we're dealing with. And so we need to move towards a policy that doesn't alienate people just because they pursue recreational use of some sort. But also what I think our current policy does is it stigmatizes and shames people who get into trouble. So addiction remains one of the health conditions that nobody stands up when they first start dealing with it and says, hey, you know, I think my cocaine use or my alcohol use or my marijuana use is leading to problems. What should I do about it? They hide. And in that hiding and in that shame from criminal prosecution, et cetera, they get themselves into deeper and deeper and deeper trouble. And by the time that we can all notice that the problem is there, you know, we're 2, 3, 4, 5, 20 years late, and we have a much, much bigger problem to deal with. So I think we can adjust our policy in that way significantly and hopefully start dealing with people much, much earlier on in the process.
Thank you to all three of you, Adi Jaffe, Lance Dodis, and Jeffrey Foote. Thank you so very much.
Thanks for having us.
Lance Dodis is former clinical professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School. He is the author of The Heart of Addiction, Breaking Addiction, and his latest, The Sober Truth, Debunking the Bad Science Behind 12-Step Programs in the Rehab Industry. Jeffrey Foote is co-founder and executive director of the Center for Motivation and Change. He was previously senior research associate at Columbia University and deputy director of alcohol treatment and research at Mount Sinai Medical Center. He is the co-author of Beyond Addiction, How Science and Kindness Help People Change. Adi Jaffe is a lecturer at UCLA and director of research, education, and innovation at Alternatives Addiction Treatment. That's it for today's Scholar Circle. Thank you to our guests and to our producers, Melissa Chiprinankine Agassian and Leonardo Alanis, for making this show possible. Also to Sud Dongre, our webmaster, and most of all to you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can go back to kpfk.org and click on the archives, or to our own archives at armudian.com and scholarcircle.org. You can also subscribe to our podcast through Stitcher or iTunes and follow us on Twitter at @armudian.
Blackbird singing in the dead of night. Take these broken wings and learn to fly all your life. You were only waiting for this moment to arise. You were only waiting for this moment to